I understood
from the Earl Shelley one.
There was a film guy who owned a cake shop, and somebody wanted to put on it, you know, Mazel Tov, Adam and Steve.
Right.
How much do you have to be Moiser Nefesh to not give that open sort of stamp of approval to such things?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, for example, what halacha are you violating if you endorse? Now, you're not Ivra and Lifnei Iver because you're not causing them to do a sin. They're going to do the sin anyway. Right? You're not causing them. But there is, however, an Isser Derabanan, thank you, called Machzikin Ivrei Aveira, meaning that's when you give people congratulations, you support them, you encourage them, you make it sound like it's a good thing. So that Lamaisa is an Isser Derabanan. So the question becomes, what are you Mechuyev to give up before you're Ivra on an Isser Derabanan? So, generally speaking, we treat the Isser Derabanan similar to positive commandments of the Torah, which means you're obligated to give up to a fifth of your wealth. So that would mean, practically speaking, a person does not have to go to jail, because that's considered to be more severe, and a person does not have to lose their business, because that would be more than a fifth of their wealth, unless they have many businesses. So there would be, there would be heterim, so to speak, to do this. But once again, one tries to avoid it. And in this case, they thought they had a very good constitutional law defense that it would be a violation of their freedom of religion. Unfortunately, they lost, but they didn't know that at the time. You know, but they would not have to go to jail for something like that. Yeah.
Could I ever speak of the reason for the prohibition by Sparta to not have fish and dairy together? Really, I know it's sourced somewhere in a Beis Yosef, but then they don't know where the source is, and then it's something to do with expert doctors at a later time.
Well, it's a shayla of the Gemara in Chulin. I mean, depending on the gears on the Gemara in Chulin, it talks about fish and meat, for example, where everybody's modi, you have to have a separation. Now, the separation between fish and meat is not based on kashrus. It's not like meat and milk, but it's based on sakana. It mentions that it could cause leprosy, it could cause saras. Now, we're not sure, is that a medical thing, or is that a Kabbalistic thing, a mystical thing? And we're not really sure what the connection is, but it is brought down that it's minion of sakana. So according to the Sephardic interpretation that the Beis Yosef brings, the sakana that exists between meat and fish is a sakana that applies to any animal product of meat and fish, which would include milk and fish. Now, even within that chumra, some are not machmer on kalim. So you'd be allowed to, according to that, you'd be allowed to cook milchiks in a fish pan or fish in a milchik pan. Others are even strict, right? So there are three levels. Some say fish and milk, no problem at all. Others say fish and milk, a problem, but fish made in a milchik pot is not a problem. And a third group, which is the strictest, will not even use fish that is cooked in a dairy pot or dairy that is cooked in a fish pot. So they have to have totally separate things. Now, nobody says you got to wait 6 hours between fish and milk, like any chumrah. But it is based on an union of sakana.
But he doesn't bring it down to Shulchan Aruch, yeah. Meaning it's mentioned the Beis Yosef, and he says to refer to that, somewhere, but you never find it.
That's correct. So halachi does not bring it. And that's basically because although the Beis Yosef was a mekubal, he was a great mekubal himself, but he tried not to be machriya halacha based on Kabbalah. Mm-hmm. And since the idea of the fish and the milk is ultimately a more of a Kabbalistic problem, even though the chara, meat and fish, is the same thing, but meat and fish became a more wider accepted minna. So the Beis Yosef didn't want to be machria on a Kabbalistic idea.
And lastly, I understand that the last psak that really comes on behalf of Sephardim really, is just as a result of expert doctors. And I guess I also don't understand how is it that we're passing according to these expert doctors that it's really encompassing all fish all over the world, I'm guessing. Wherever Sephardi is all over the world, it can applies to him.
Well, again, it really depends on this fundamental question. That is the fish and milk a medical issue, or is it a Kabbalistic issue? Meaning, sometimes the combination of food could be mazik a person, not because there's any medical reason, but you know, mystically it's a ruach hatuma or whatever it is. Now, if it is a health problem, then indeed it is shayach for later doctors to make decisions that it's not a health problem. For example, the Rambam was a doctor, and the Rambam in the Mishneh Torah gives us medical advice, but he does not quote the medical advice given in the Gemara. The Gemara also has many pages of medical advice in Maseches Brachos, Maseches Kitten, Maseches Shabbos, different refuas, and the Rambam leaves it out. Because the Rambam apparently held, if Chazal were speaking medically, that's a matter of science, and that can change with later opinions. Other shitas, like the Vilna Gaon, took a different position. The Vilna Gaon said that, granted, we don't understand the refuas of the Gemara, but the refuas of the Gemara do not work medically, they work mystically. So that would be the similar machlokas. How do you understand some of these health hazards?
Could the Rabbi please respond? What's the definition for true Talmid Chacham? Does he have to know like whole shas, always somebody who does not know much?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. The definition of
a true Talmid Chacham.
Oh, a true Talmid Chacham.
Does he know?
Yeah,
the whole shas, or does he have to put the meters?
So there are two Gemaras actually which give contradictory definitions. One definition of a Talmid Chacham is a person that you could ask a shayla in any area of Torah, and he would be able to give you an answer. Maybe by looking it up, it doesn't necessarily mean on the top of his head, but he would be able to find an answer and give you an answer. There's another Gemara that says a Talmud Chacham is anybody who knows anything clearly. Even if he only knows like one little thing, but he knows it very, very well, that would make him a Talmud Chacham. Lemaisa, we paskin more like the first definition, that the status of a Talmud Chacham is someone that you could ask, and the poskim say it doesn't necessarily mean every area of Torah, but it means in most areas of Torah they will be able to give you some type of response. Now, on the other hand, the Ramah says, with respect to certain laws, like not having to pay taxes, Talmud Chacham is pater from taxes, bizman hazeh, we don't have a din Talmud Chacham. In other words, we're not great enough. I mean, Talmid Chachamim are not great enough to say we're pater from taxes. But in terms of respect and honor, we go with a person that you could answer most places in the Torah. Now, I also want to just point out one little thing. You have to differentiate. There are two different mitzvos about people who are learned in Torah. One is to honor a Talmid Chacham. That's one halacha. The other is to honor your Rebbe. So remember that you have to always honor a person who taught you Torah, even if they may not qualify as a Talmud Chacham. That's a separate getter. That's the chiyuv of honoring a Rebbe. So that's also a chiyuv like that. Yeah.
How likely is it that the Rambam recanted and accepted Kavanah? And if that would be the case, how many changes would that make with his Tzachim and like his Hashgafa?
You know, I think that's I don't want to get in trouble, but that's clearly a made up story. That's above a maisa, and because people couldn't conceive, how is it possible that the great Rambam could not go with Kabbalah? So you make up a story. Well, at the end of his life, he just said everything he did was a mistake. You know, that didn't happen. However, you do have to understand that when we say the Rambam rejected Kabbalah, that is not true either. Because although the Rambam expresses himself philosophically, but clearly the philosophy was also combined with a mystical connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Rambam describes Avas Hashem and Dveikus Bashem in a very, very mystical way. And in reality, there is not necessarily a complete contradiction between philosophy and Kabbalah. In fact, there were Kabbalists who actually expressed Kabbalistic truths with philosophical concepts. This was Rav Moshe Cordovero. In Sfat, in the 1500s, the Ari HaKadosh, Rav Yosef Karo was there, he was the Rav of Sfat, and the Arizal came when he was 37, and he died at 39. He just died 2 years later, very young man. But before the Arizal, there was another very, very great Mekubal whose life overlapped with the Ari, and the Arizal was machshif him tremendously. And that was Rav Moshe Cordovero. And Rav Moshe Cordovero wrote many, many Sfarim. He wrote a Perish on the Zohar. He wrote a beautiful, beautiful Musar Sefer, Taimer Devira, which people still learn, and it's a very, very beautiful Sefer to learn about how the 13 principles of Hashem's mercy, we can live them in our own lives, and that's how we get Hashem's mercy, by following those midas. But his magnum opus, his masterwork, is a big, big volume called Pardes Rimonim, which means the Garden of Pomegranates. And this is his attempt to systematically and logically and philosophically explain Kabbalistic ideas. And Rav Moshe Cordovero was known as the Mora Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed of Kabbalah. Now, his system, again, I'm just being very superficial here, his system was kind of superseded by the Arizal's Kabbalah. But the Arizal's Kabbalah is much less susceptible to philosophical analysis. It is more spiritual. It is very difficult to communicate and to articulate and to explain, etc. So that's when you have a big divide between philosophy and Kabbalah. But in Moshe Cordovero, there wasn't such a divide. And I should mention much later, the Bala Tanya, right? Rav Shneur Zalman tried to combine philosophy and mysticism. In fact, even a work like Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Creation, which is a work that describes how Hashem created the world by the combination of the letters of the alphabet, there were many that looked at Sefer Yetzirah as a philosophical work, not a Kabbalistic work, even though to us it seems pashut that it would be in Kabbalah. So the division between Kabbalah and philosophy was not so clear, so consequently, I don't think the Rambam recanted that much, I do not believe at all. But to say he was totally rejecting of Kabbalah, I don't think is true either. Because I think that in his philosophy, there were mystical ideas that were incorporated.
I was wondering, what are the reasons that when we're reading the Megillah, there's certain lines that everyone reads with the Balkorah?
It's a minog. It's not a din. And in fact, it's not even mentioned in the Gemara of Eferish. But it's a way of, remember, the idea of Mikra Megillah is called Pirsumei Nisa. Pirsumei Nisa is to publicize the miracle, make a public spectacle. So at critical points, like, you know, when Mordechai, gets to be the second to the king, etc., and the like, the whole Tzibur wants to participate in the miracle. Now, one exception to that is that one of the things we do read aloud are the 10 sons of Haman. Now there already, there's a lumdisher reason for that, that the Rugged Shover gives. And that is the following. Most of us do not read the Megillah, right? We hear the Chazan read it. And why are we Yotzei? We're Yotzei under a principle that is called Shomei Kaona. That's how we're Yotzei Tkiyat Shofar. That's how we're Yotzei Kiddush. That's how we're Yotzei Kriyas HaTorah. That's how we're Yotzei Megillah. We're Yotzei Megillah Shomeya Kaona. When you listen and you have Kavana to be Yotzei, it is as if you said it. Now, the Rugachever wants to say, Shomeya Kaona means it's like you said it, but whenever there's something more you have to do than just say it, it's not going to work. Now, Aseres B'nai Haman, the halacha is, the 10 sons of Haman have to be read with one breath, because they were all hung up together. Neshima Achas. Right, it's a little difficult. You know, if you hear some say, you know, some doctors, and you have to say Aseres at the end too, and the like. So the Rugachever says, you know, if I didn't read the words and I just have Shomeya Kaina, even if it's Kaina, it's not Aina Bineshima Achas. Therefore, I have to read it out loud Bineshima Achas to get that in. Now the truth is, there is support to the Rugachever's idea from an interesting comment of the Beis Halevi. The Beis Halevi says, do you say Shamea Kaina by Birchas Kohanim? Let's say I'm a Kohen and I have laryngitis, or my jaw is sewn shut because of an accident or something. Can one Kohen say the words to be motzi the other Kohen in Birchas Kohanim? Do I say Shomea Kohana? I'm a Kohen. Now, remember, that's not talking about us. If we're Yisraelim, we're not being, we're being blessed, we're not being Yaitseh. But the question is, can one Kohen say the words for another Kohen? So the Beis Halevi says no, because Birchas Kohanim is not just something that you say, it has to be said in a loud voice. And Shomea Kohana might be Kohana, but it's not Aina loudly. So the Ragajaber says, Hu Adin, it's not Aina B'Nishimachas. That's a little bit of a lumdus. Now, let me mention one thing. You know, one of the verses that we recite out loud in the Megillah is La Yehudim Haisa Ora V'Simcha V'Sason, that the Jews had light and joy and... Right? Now, you'll recall, of course, that we say that verse every Moshe Shabbos in Havdalah, and we say that out loud as well. Now, it's interesting that I believe, I don't want to say 100% because you can always miss something, that it's not brought down in the Mishnah Berurah or the Poskim generally, that you say La Yehudim Haisa'ara out loud. And some have suggested that that's simply an erroneous transposition of what we do by Megillah Esther. Since by Megillah Esther we say it out loud, so it's almost an instinctive response. Whenever we hear those words, we say it out loud. But in fact, the minhag was only for Megillah Esther, it was not for Havdalah. Which would mean, of course, according to that shita, Kain Tialanu, which is only in Havdalah, it's not in Megillah Esther. That Bichlal shouldn't be said out loud. But okay, it doesn't hurt. It's not a hefsek, because until the brachos are recited, you're allowed to interrupt that initial part. Yeah?
The Chol Yisrael and Chol Stam, in Chutzaretz you find Chol Stam milks like with heksherin. So I'm wondering what that heksher is, what that means, because if the milk was being overseen by a Jewish kosher agency, wouldn't that be then Chol Yisrael?
Yeah, I'm not familiar. You've seen Chol Stam with the heksher. Are you talking about a product or in the milk itself?
A milk with an OU, I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
And it's Chol Stam?
I'm pretty sure.
I'm amazed. Now what I do understand would be, they may certify a whole product, like a pizza or something, even though it's Chol Stam, because they're certifying that all the ingredients are kosher, that there's hasn't been treif, and the like, and then there's Sobech and Chol Stam. But if all they're doing is certifying milk, I can't understand why they would put an OU on Chalav Stam. I mean, milk, Chalav Stam doesn't have to be certified. Chalav Stam doesn't have to be certified. I mean, if you're Sumich on Chalav Stam, I'll check it. I'm not sure if there is such a thing, but...
And then also, yeah. Just like a follow-up, I'm sure it's been asked many times, but, how do we kind of view Chalav Stam, Chalav Stam, what people hold today, what should we do,
Well, there's no question what you should do. There is no question. Obviously, a person should keep the halachas of Chalav Yisrael. That's a din in the Gemara. It's an Isra Drabbanan to drink unsupervised milk, because the Chachamim were afraid that there would be a non-kosher milk mixed in, which, by the way, for many, many years was not a problem in America. It's beginning to be a problem. One would wonder if Rav Moshe might change his psaka, because people are now talking about importing camel milk and donkey milk. There are different types of imports because there are people who make very big health benefits for donkey milk. It goes back to the ancient world. The Cleopatra used to take a bath in donkey milk, or whatever it is. So there are going to be issues. But those who have Chalav Stam, we are Somech, of course, on a very, very famous tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein, who basically says that the Chachamim assured the milk because of a fear of adulteration. But when you have governmental inspection, and when you have very serious fines for adulterating milk, right? The USDA, the Department of Agriculture, is always checking in on that. So that is just as good. That's Chalav Stam. That is just as good as a Jewish person watching the milking. And therefore, Rav Moshe says that Chalav Stam Me'ikir Hadin is Mutter. But Rav Moshe says at the same time, as he gives the Heter, that a Yirei Shemayim should be strict. Now, the big question is, there are many, many questions. Even if you try to keep Chol of Yisrael, there are many, you know, ins and outs. For example, powdered milk. Products that are made with powdered milk. Now, you may know that the Rabbanut of Eretz Yisrael, the Rabbanut HaReshit, accepts a psak of a very, very great gadol around 50 years ago, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, who was the Rav of Yerushalayim, and again, he was truly a great, great gadol. But he happened to say that the Isser of Chalav Akum does not apply to powdered milk. And as a result, Avkat Chalav, he said, would be mutter. On the other hand, many, many people, particularly Hasidim, are not Samech on that at all. Right? So many products that might be certified Chalav Yisrael, if it's Avkat Chalav, milk powder, that would not be acceptable. And then there are generally going to be issues about Kalim. In other words, let's assume that I keep Chalav Yisrael, right? I don't have Chalav Stam. Am I allowed to eat a Parav product that was prepared in the same utensil? Do I treat non-Chalav Yisrael as treif, in which case, even if it was made in the vessel, I'm not allowed to eat? Or do I say, no, I don't drink the milk itself, but I'm not going to be machmir on Parav things prepared in the Kalim. Optimally, one should, if you're machmir Chalav Yisrael, then even Parav chocolate that's processed on the dairy equipment, one should not eat, but some are makel on it. So even within Chol of Yisrael, there are more leniencies or more stringencies, depending on which way you go. But it is proper to keep Chol of Yisrael if you can. Even Rav Moshe, who is the big makel, insisted on it. One interesting issue that is now making the rounds in Eretz Yisrael is whether surveillance cameras can satisfy the Chol of Yisrael requirement. In other words, let's assume you have Arab farmers who are milking cows, and there's no mashgiach who wants to go there. Maybe it's too dangerous. But what they do set up is they set up a surveillance camera in which everything is being videoed. Now, maybe somebody will see, maybe not. Now, somebody doesn't sit and watch every single thing. But the question is, does that create enough fear that you're being watched, not you, but the guy is being watched, that he's not going to pull any shtick? The Rabbanut, I'm not sure if they actually do it, but the Rabbanut announced that they were going to be somech on video surveillance for Chol of Yisrael without an actual mashgiach coming to visit, because the video surveillance creates what is called mirsas, fear, and that would be sufficient. I know that at least Chabad totally rejects that, so Chabad now is not going to rely on any Chol of Yisrael certification of the Rabbanut, since that is based on video surveillance. So even within Chol of Yisrael, there are going to be, you know, ins and outs of how strict you're going to be, but as a general concept, you should keep it. Yeah.
There's a Gemara Sukkah. We're learning our rasks this year. We're curious about a few things. One is that there's a story about Simcha and Sason, two heretics. We want to know what some of the meaning might be of this story.
Yeah.
Also, one thing I was curious about is it says when you go up the Kevesh, and then I think it says you turn right, but really it seems like you're turning left. That's just the technical question. And also, the Tzedukim, it seems like, are very either stubborn or they have something more that we don't know about, because there's a lot of evidence piled up against believing in the tradition. Things like the Kohen Gadol dying every year for a long period of time because he was doing something that the Tzedukim would disagree with is the tradition.
Oh, so you're saying, so how, I mean, the Tzedukim seem to have been disproven all the time.
Right, so how?
Yeah. Let me take it in reverse order. You know, that is a good question. But, you know, in a way, this is what Chazal say. Rishayim don't change their mind, even if they're on the entranceway of Gehenna, right? They're on their way down to Gehenna. They say, I'm right. And, you know, also you have to keep in mind, too, that according to many Meforshim, the death of the Kohen Gadol was not as dramatic as you would think. In other words, some bring down a Zohar that says there was a chain or a rope around the Kohen Gadol and they would pull his dead body out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. But most Meforshim don't say that. Most Meforshim say he actually didn't die in Yom Kippur. God would not mar Yom Kippur with the death of a Kohen Gadol. But it means in the course of the year he got sick and he died, but it wasn't right away, and people could attribute it to age or health, so it wasn't as compelling. Again, as I say, the Yetzer is very, very strong. You know, the Tzedukim were wealthy, they were politically well connected, they had what you might call the best of Olam Hazeh as compared to the Prushim, who were poor and oppressed. So the Tzedukim could look at the Prushim and say, you see, God really loves us more, because that is why we are respected by the Romans, that is why we are admired. If you look at, if you ever see these models of Yerushalayim, I don't know if you ever saw the, it used to be called the Holy Land model because it was the Holy Land Hotel, now it's in the Israel Museum. But you can clearly see that Yerushalayim had fancy neighborhoods and they had slums. You actually see very, very different types of houses. The fancy neighborhoods were the Tzedukim, and the slums were the Prushim, right? So, you know, there are different cheshbainas there. Now, that was your last question. What was the question before?
Turning left. It says you go up the ramp.
No, the halacha always is that you have to turn right, except there are some exceptions where you turn left for the pouring of the wine. And the reason that is so is that the corner of the Mizbeach that you pour the wine is the southwest corner, which would be the last, if you turned right, that would be the last corner you would get. And the problem is the wine will be adversely affected by the smoke and by the fire. So when it is something like wine that's going to be ruined, then you make a special dispensation to turn left. And the same thing is true if you're going to slaughter a bird offering, because the bird is small and the bird is going to get also choked by the smoke. So those are the exceptions that allow you to turn left to get to the southwest corner first. But if all you're doing is carrying blood and you're going to sprinkle the blood, there's no wine or live animal that you're dealing with, you turn right.
Yeah, I guess I was under the impression that when the Kohen walks up the ramp, does a sidestep to the corner if he's doing a normal offering, and then he turns like this and faces the inside of the Mizbeach to sidestep along that edge now.
The ramp. Okay, let's say this table is the Mizbeach. Okay, and this is west, right? You're west, right? This is towards the Kodesh HaKadoshim. I'm east. The ramp is here, which is south. The Kohen Gadol. No, not to go to any Kohen walks. Let's say a chatas, a sin offering, was slaughtered, and the Kohen has to sprinkle the blood on each corner of the Mizbeach. This is a sin offering, a chatas. So what he does is he walks up the southern ramp. He then turns right. Right when he reaches the top of the Mizbeach, he turns right. He walks right towards this corner.
Turning right does not mean he faces his body, though. It just means he sidesteps, or does he?
No, he actually turns right.
Okay.
Because it's like a sidewalk. The top of the Mizbeach is very big, and there actually is the equivalent of a sidewalk border that he walks. He walks on a board. He walks on a sidewalk, and he literally turns right till he reaches this corner, which is the southeast corner, and then he continues walking.
He turns at that point, but the turn that we're talking about is not that he turns his body, because at that point he would turn left to start walking the other.
That might be so, but we're talking about the initial turn. The initial turn, right, the ramp is in the middle. So when he gets to the top of the Mizbeach, he then turns right and walks right. So he takes a right turn, with some exceptions for things like a live bird offering or blood, where he has to do it in the southwest corner, and the smoke would ruin the wine or kill the bird, right? So that's an exception, so to speak. Okay.
The story, that
would take a little longer. I want to look at the story. I need to look at all the details again. But these are great names. These are obviously symbolic names, and Chazal are sometimes trying to communicate a message through the medium of a story. But I'll look at the mic. Yeah.
So, we hear about Kabbalists a lot. So what do they actually do, like practicing Kabbalists on a daily basis?
So here's the thing. You have to know, there actually is. Most Kabbalists do not practice Kabbalah. That's the thing. In fact, what is called practical Kabbalah, which the Hebrew term is
Kabbalah Ma'asis is actually strongly discouraged even by Kabbalists. So most Kabbalists, if they're true Kabbalists, they're not fakers, spend their day learning, and a lot of their day they're learning, you know, Gemara, the Zayin and Gemara, and Shulchan Aruch, and Halacha, but they will devote also a few hours to learning the Zohar, the Arizal, and other Kabbalistic works.
What did the Arizal do? What was he up to?
Well, the Ari himself, okay. The Ari's writings, the books of the Ari, which are not really books he wrote, these are books that were written by his Talmud, Rav Chaim Vital, based on the Ari's teachings. We call them the Ari's writings. They're also not about doing stuff. They're about explaining the deep structure of the universe, the names of God and the significance of them. They are learning. They are trying to understand. Now, it happens to be that because the Arizal was a person of Ruach HaKodesh approaching prophecy, the Arizal was able to do miracles. He was able to do all sorts of supernatural things. But that is not what most Kabbalists do. Most Kabbalists are relatively undramatic in the sense that they're learning very powerful things, but they are learning it to become closer to Hashem, and really to improve the world by bringing holiness into the world in an indirect way. But they're not, you know, levitating people. They're not exorcising demons from people. They're not doing miracles. And in fact, this was considered to be very, very dangerous, because although a Kabbalist will say that they have the power to, may say that they have a way of unlocking power to do these things, they also say that it's very, very dangerous. And well, because you're kind of unlocking a power, but the power you're unlocking may be much more powerful than you're able to control or master. Really, the truth of the matter is the intuition, Mahavdil, I don't mean to compare it, but the intuition behind stories like Frankenstein and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, in which you tap into some forces and then you can't control them, is actually very, very descriptive of what the Gedolim and the Mekubalim have said is the danger of Kabbalah Ma'asis. So there were some Mekubalim who were very heavily involved in this, but over the past few hundred years, almost, it's been very, very discouraged. So Kabbalah today, to the extent people learn Kabbalah, I mean, there aren't that many Mekubalim, but the people who learn Kabbalah today, it is primarily learning to understand the Arizal's systems and the Zohar's systems, and to then use those systems to grow and increase our Avodas Hashem. So it's less dramatic. It's not as exciting as you might think.
So they live in the same reality.
Oh, yeah. Your next-door neighbor could be a Kabbalist. You know, you wouldn't even know. Rav Yaakov Hillel Shlita, yeah, who's a Mekubal, lives in Arzei Abira with everybody else. You know, they don't live in a separate secret universe or something like that. You can even talk to them. You can say, "Good Shabbos, how are you?" You can ask him how his son is doing. You know, he'll answer you, you know. So a Kabbalist is not necessarily an otherworldly person. Not now, again, if you're asking me what would I react if the Arizal walked into the room? Okay, you would probably faint. Okay, whatever. Or die or something, I don't know. That may be true. But on the average, as I say, on the average, Kabbalists are great people. Obviously, they've achieved levels that are higher than us, but they're still part of the human race.
So the main risk is like, what, losing your mind and stuff if you get too deep into it?
Or? There's losing your mind, but well, to tell you the truth, I mean, there is not only losing your mind, there is potentially dying. Yeah. Remember, great Kabbalists died very young, and there seems to be a connection. The Arizal died at 39, Rav Moshe Cordovero died at 47, a modern person, not on the same Madrega, but a very Chashuv Rav Arye Kaplan, Zatzal, also died as a young man, and although I can't say, you know, it's from Kabbalah, I personally, again, I have no raya for this, but I strongly feel that it was connected to Kabbalah. Well, what happens is this, because Kabbalah connects you to God in a very powerful way, and when your soul yearns to be with God, the soul does not want to be in the body anymore. It leaves, it pushes out, it wants to get out of here, and you're not going to be able to hold it back if it wants to leave, right? So you're dealing with scary things. You're dealing with the very, very powerful. And already in the time of the Gemara itself mentions, there were great rabbis who went into the paradise of heaven to see the secrets of God. And one of them became a heretic. one of them became crazy, mentally imbalanced, and one of them died, and only Rabbi Akiva is the one that went in b'shalom. So that type of Kabbalah, you got to be very, very careful. In fact, Rabbi Ari Kaplan writes in his books on meditation, when he talks about Kabbalistic meditations on God's name, he says, it almost sounds, you know, facetious, but he says this very seriously, do not do this meditation alone. Be sure there is somebody in the room with you to pull you back to earth. Because if you do it alone, you might not be able to come back. And people, now there are there are mystical forces that come from the dark side. This is called the Sitra Achra. There's forces that come from the good and forces that come from the evil. And people do talk about people who are not Mekubalim, but they're mystically oriented, perhaps from Buddhism or whatever it is. And they talk about out-of-body experiences. And they'll even talk about, gee, you know, it was hard getting my soul back into my body. They talk about these things. And, you know, I don't know if it's a true thing that happened or not, but I would guess it is true. Because even if it comes from the Sitra Achra, that's true. In other words, it's happening. It is happening, but it comes from a dangerous place. So you got to be careful. Yeah?
In the Chumash, when it says it's the four animals that have one sign of kashrus and not the other,
yep.
Do we take that to mean that there are those only four in the entire world, or just those are some, just four?
Well, the Gemara seems to indicate that that this is one of the proofs of the divine origin of the Torah, that the Torah makes such a claim which no human being would be able to say, because no human being doesn't know that there wouldn't be another animal that qualifies. And as a result, this is taken as a proof for divinity. So at least at this point, that is our understanding of it. It is only those four and nothing else, and that is one of the proofs that the Torah comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu.
So then if some scientist or something finds an animal that fits the category that's not in the Chumash, what would we say then?
Well, again, I mean, you're asking me a hypothetical question, meaning, what if the Torah is proved wrong? What do we say then? Okay, but again, that's my meaning. we will say the Torah will not be proven wrong, and if it happens, come back and ask the question then. But so far it hasn't happened, right? And we believe it hasn't happened because the Torah is telling you the truth. Now, what might be the case, though, is you might have to know, and that is even animals that seem like different species, perhaps there's a commonality that would make them one. For example, there are many types of pigs and many types of bison and many types of buffaloes, right? So it may very well be that under a definition of what is a common species, it would still fall under that category. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Grafting, there's a prohibition on grafting fruits onto different trees.
That's correct.
What about hybridized, like I know there's a pear apple type thing, and then the other fruit, are we allowed to eat those things?
Yeah, so this is a very important point. Unfortunately, I do have to stop exactly on time tonight. But I'll get your question later, I apologize. Yeah, but it is important to know that although hybridization is a forbidden activity, it does not extend to the eating of the fruit. So people who did it committed a sin, but the fruit is not treif, and it can be eaten. So it really does not apply to us in that sense. So we're okay. Okay, maybe one more. Yeah.
What is it about a woman when she gets married that now her hair becomes an erva, and why is that before it's not, and once she gets
married? Yeah, very, very excellent question. Hair is obviously... I'm sorry, Jen.
And also, what is it? Does a goy's hair, is that erva?
No, it is not. It's very interesting that we normally know the laws of tznius, like, to uncover the leg above the knee and to uncover the arm above the elbow, whatever it is, a low-cut dress, that never makes a difference between married women and single women. If it's sexually stimulating, it's sexually stimulating. We never differentiate between a married woman and a single woman. The only law of tznius that differentiates between a married woman and a single woman is covering hair. A single woman's hair, at least our minog is uncovered, although it shouldn't necessarily be wild. It's good to be braided, but it can certainly be uncovered. A married woman is required by the Torah to have her hair covered, at least when she's outside in a public place. Again, in the privacy of the home, that's a very big machlokes. Okay, that's a separate thing. But in the street, you know, 100%, it is a daraisa. Now, if you say, well, that's because hair is, you know, beautiful hair is sexually stimulating. Well, if that's the case, why would it be permitted for a single person and the like? And besides, that gets to the other issue. Some of the human hair wigs, shetels, that women wear are actually much nicer than their hair, you know, so that's kind of a funny little thing. So the short answer is that the chayra, covering hair, is not because hair is sexually stimulating, but rather since the hair represents the extension of the face, of the personality of a person. So the idea of covering hair is the notion that the woman is saying to herself, actually, my innermost self now belongs to my family, to my husband, as a family unit. It is not there to be shared with the rest of the world. Now, what then happens is, it's a reversal. Once there's a mitzvah to cover hair, then when the hair is uncovered, it now becomes sexually stimulating. Meaning, unlike covering the knee, which you must cover the knee because it's sexually stimulating, it's the other way around. Hair is sexually stimulating only when it has to be covered. Until it had to be covered, it was not intrinsically stimulating in that way. And the reason for its covering is not because of sexual stimulation. Sexual stimulation is a consequence of the obligation to cover hair and the like. But we'll talk, that again deserves more time. Okay, have a good week. Yeah. See you.
Also, when she was by a Jew, would not keep mitzvah.
Once again,
the hair wouldn't be by a Jew, would not keep mitzvah.